Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and happy Monday to you. If there is one song that really captures the feel of Motown and Detroit and America in the early and mid-1960s, one might argue it's Martha Reeves singing Dancin' in the Streets. On today's show, we talk about the historical importance of this Motown classic. Then we explore the concept behind community cafes, find out how they work and where you can find one near you. But first, this promises to be an important week for the state Senate. This could be the week the Senate decides whether or not to expand Medicaid to 470,000 more low-income adults in Michigan. Now, you might recall the Senate broke off for its summer break in June without voting on Medicaid, something that so incensed Governor Snyder that he came home early from a trade trip to Israel in order to publicly scold the Senate, telling them they should vote, take a vote, and not a vacation. Well, 2 months later, it appears a vote is at hand. Let's set the stage now as we check in with the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, Rick Pluta. Rick, just to break it down, explain just what is this proposed Medicaid expansion?
Sure. Now, you remember when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the Federal Affordable Care Act, one of the things is they struck down a mandate that states expand their Medicaid programs, but they said states could opt in. So that's really what this is about, whether or not Michigan is going to opt into that part of the Affordable Care Act. Governor Snyder says it's a good idea that more people will be healthy. Healthier people will be less of a burden on the healthcare system. And that means that everyone will ultimately pay less than they might otherwise for healthcare if we extend Medicaid to basically to more working poor people.
Now, there's no shortage of voices urging the Senate to vote no. So what are the main arguments against?
The arguments that the people who are urging a no vote are that these are, you know, Tea Party conservative elements within the Republican Party. They see this as a big expansion of government. They say that it will cost more money, and that is a debt that will be passed on to succeeding generations. And the people who are arguing for it are saying, look, you're paying for uninsured people to get health care now, whether you like it or not. What we're doing is we're taking that burden and we're managing it better and making it less expensive.
Now, have the critics offered any viable alternatives?
Well, I guess that depends on your definition of viable. That when this comes up for a vote in the state Senate in the next day or two, that there will be some more alternative, more free market oriented, private sector oriented the plans on the table. One would use tax incentives to get people to create healthcare savings account. Another one would basically sort of try to create a private sector model for Obamacare. But the governor is rejecting those that the administration says that they'd be expensive, unmanageable. And the state house leadership, because remember, after this gets done in the Senate, the state house still has to concur with whatever they do. The house leadership says that they don't see these as viable plans.
Now, can Michigan still get in on this if they do vote yes? We've got January 1 is looming. Is it too late for Michigan to start covering more enrollees?
No, that time is growing short if we're going to do it on time. And actually, the administration is already making contingency plans, because even if we don't hit that January 1st target, we could still start it on February 1st or March 1st or something like that. The only problem is that we would lose a month of federal funding for every month of delay, and the numbers are huge. The director of the Department of Community Health, Jim Haveman, says that the cost to Michigan would be $7 million daily if we don't do this and lost funding.
So when do you expect the vote to happen, Rick?
It will either be tomorrow or Wednesday. What will happen tomorrow morning is the Senate Republican caucus will go and meet behind closed doors to sort of thrash this out. And they'll make a decision on whether they vote, what they're going to vote on, whether it'll be just the Medicaid expansion, maybe the Medicaid expansion and one or two of these alternative bills. The Senate leadership thinks that they may have about 10 senators on board, which, with all the Democrats supporting it, would put them across the goal line. But as someone I talked to this morning said, you know, everything can change on game day.
That's Rick Pluta, who is the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, keeping an eye on this impending vote on Medicaid expansion in Michigan Senate. Thank you so much, Rick.
Oh, my pleasure.
A proposal by a Canadian power company to store nuclear waste at a site within a mile of Lake Huron is setting off alarm bells on this side of the border. Ontario Power Generation is the company. It's drawing up plans to store low to medium level nuclear waste at an underground repository that it wants to build in Ontario, near the town of Kincardine. That is on the shore of Lake Huron. And critics, including some state lawmakers, are worrying that storing nuclear waste so close to the lake could threaten the drinking water for 40 million people. Detroit News reporter Jim Lynch has been following this story. He joins us now from Detroit. Jim, just what kind of storage facility does Ontario Power Generation want to build?
What they're talking about is called a deep geologic repository. It's a facility that's constructed roughly 2,200 feet beneath the surface, and in this case, it's also about three-quarters of a mile from the shores of Lake Huron.
So I'm wondering, Jim, why is OPG looking so close to the lake? You have to wonder, is there no other place in Ontario that could be a repository for nuclear waste, someplace perhaps landlocked?
Well, there are two basic reasons that it appears that they're looking at the Kincardine site. The first is, and Ontario Power Generation will tell you this, what they've got there is a particular geologic makeup that makes it suitable for this type of storage. They'll say that it's a low permeability limestone and shale formation that they think is going to be able to lock this material in without any sort of escape for maybe 1,000 years or so. The second issue is Kincardine itself is home to the Bruce Nuclear Generating Station, which is one of the larger nuclear plants in the world. And as such, it is a large employer of people in the Kincardine area. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to find an area that is welcoming to a project like this, it doesn't hurt to have a large part of the population over there employed by Ontario Power Generation.
So over here on this side of the border, there are people objecting. Taylor's Democratic Senator Hoon-Young Hopgood, for one, holding town hall meetings and posting videos. What are the main objections that critics here in Michigan have to this?
Essentially, the fear is that by storing the material there, it is a threat to the drinking water source for millions of people here in the Great Lakes region. There have been efforts to pass resolutions, and there have been efforts to sort of draw some more communication between the United States and Canada about the issue. But to be honest, so far, it's all been fairly symbolic up to this point.
Because it makes me wonder, is there any legitimate pressure that Michigan lawmakers could exert on an Ontario power company or even the Ministry of Environment, for that matter?
There is, actually. The United States is in a position to go through the Canadian courts and sue in any way that an aggrieved property owner who lives nearby something objectionable might also file a complaint. So they do have the legal recourse. In addition, the United States could also ask the International Joint Commission to step in and barter some sort of discussion between the two sides. The IJC was essentially created for just this type of border dispute. And for some reason, no one has asked them to get involved so far.
But it does seem like the ball is certainly rolling in Ontario. What kind of timetable is at play here?
Next month, in September, they're going to start a public hearing in the Kincardine area, and then they'll have another one the following month. If these proposals just move forward, it could be maybe February before the issue is turned over to Ontario's Minister of Environment. And after it's in the ministry's hands, essentially it could get final approval sometime next year.
Are the concerns over, just your thoughts, are the concerns over safety and the possible impact on Lake Huron water, are they warranted, or is this the kind of thing where as soon as people hear the words nuclear and or radioactive, then alarm bells go off?
I guess I'm not in a position to say whether scientifically whether it's accurate to think that there is a real contamination danger to the drinking water, but there's a reason that the United States walked away from its proposal to bury nuclear waste underground in the Yucca Mountain project. For some reason, after years of study and millions of dollars invested in research, they weren't able to get that project finalized. So right now, there's a reason that it isn't happening in the United States. You have to wonder why they think that it's worth doing in Canada.
it also, as I thought about this, it kind of struck me that this could be an example of that 21st century dilemma there, where we want cheap, abundant energy and we want to loosen our ties to Middle East oil, but we do not want to face up to possible consequences of seeking energy from another source, in this case, nuclear.
That's certainly true. And nuclear still sort of struggles with the image of it being a dangerous power source, and the incidents that have happened in the last year or two in Japan have certainly not helped that.
No, and even as you hear OPG saying, well, it'll be good for 1,000 years, and you're thinking, well, what about the poor souls who are living around Kincardine or around Lake Huron in 1,000 years?
True, and there's one more thing I'd like to point out. There are concerns among people on both sides of Lake Huron that Ontario Power Generation's stated plans might expand in the future. What they have said in the past is that this is strictly going to be limited to low to medium level waste. At the same time they're moving this project forward, supposedly they're in the process of searching for an additional site to house the high level waste. Now, I guess the pessimists out there are worried that maybe after a year or two of the low to medium level waste being stored near Kincardine, that at some point Ontario Power Generation may turn around and say, well, look, it's worked here for several years without a problem. Why don't we just bury the high-level waste here as well?
Or as my mom used to say, give them an inch, they'll take a mile.
Indeed.
Jim Lynch is a reporter with the Detroit News. Thank you very much for the update, Jim.
Cindy, thanks for having me.
Still to come, we learn about a community cafe in Dearborn using a pay-what-you-can model to feed those who need it the most. That's in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For many, that song is Motown music, Dancing in the Street, written by Mickey Stevenson, Ivy Joe Hunter, and Marvin Gaye, and recorded in 2 takes, less than 10 minutes, by Martha Reeves. Well, little did they know, after slapping down Martha's vocals in that studio in Hitsville on West Grand Boulevard, that they'd created a song that would come to represent a watershed moment in history, Motown's history, Detroit's history, and America's history. Writer Mark Kurlansky tells us the story of how this hit Motown song became the rallying point for important moments in history. His newest book is called Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America. And Mark Kurlansky joins us now. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Nice to be talking to you.
Take us back, if you will, to that day in June 1964. Martha Reeves got on a bus and went from her home on Detroit's east side over to the west side where Hitsville was. And she wasn't even supposed to be recording that day, was she?
No. You know, Berry Gordy built Motown by grabbing all of these talented kids out of high school. And it should be remembered that the only reason this was possible, because this was a day in which high schools, public high schools in poor urban neighborhoods, had great music programs, most of which have been cut now.
Yes.
You know, so kids got out of high school, if they had musical talent, you know, they not only knew how to sing or play instruments, but they could read music, they understood music theory, they understood how harmony worked. And they would try to, you know, somehow get a foot in at Hitsville, Motown, and they'd go over to the studio, and you know, if you hung out there, good things happened. You know, sooner or later, Diane Ross got her start. You know, someday somebody's going to say, "Hey, you try this."
Yeah.
And you know, she was over there just doing what the young talent did over there, and she heard that Marvin Gaye was recording a new song called Dancing in the Street. And she didn't think much of that title. She told me that she would have much rather done a song about dancing in an elegant ballroom. I mean, that's Martha, you know.
Yes, we know her. So she hears about, you know, Marvin's in the studio, and she had a little crush on him anyway, didn't she?
I think she always had a crush on him, and she started singing backup for him. So she went into Studio A there to see what he was up to. And Marvin Gaye saw her and said to Mickey Stevenson, "Hey, why don't we let Martha do this?" Just like that, you know. And you know, 50 years later, Martha still remembers this as the moment when Marvin Gaye handed her the song.
Wow.
That wasn't it at all. That was happening.
What was happening?
The three of them had written the song in the home of Mickey Stevenson and his wife,
Kim Weston. Yeah.
And the song was for Kim. And they always used to make a demo tape for the artist to listen to for a while before their recording session. And they were just there trying to make a demo tape. And it occurred to Marvin Gaye that a demo tape for Kim with Martha singing would be a lot better than with him singing. Because it wasn't really his kind of thing. I mean, he wrote it, but it wasn't the kind of song that he sang.
Right.
But then after she sang it, she just so nailed it that they just couldn't imagine anybody else singing it, which was, of course, a huge problem for Mickey Stevenson, who had promised it to his wife.
And she really nailed it in two takes, correct? One, they said they weren't rolling, although that's not
this
real
was
clear.
Another thing that they never told her.
Yeah.
So I was sitting in Martha's old house in the living room there on the east side, and she's sitting to the right of me, and Ivy Jo Hunter is sitting to my left, and we're talking about this, and she's telling me this old story that she's told 100 times that everybody knows about how she sang it, and then they told her that they messed up and failed to record it, so she had to sing it again. So I sort of asked the obvious question. You know, I used to be a reporter. You know? the question that sort of hangs there is which take was better, you know, because the other take is lost now. So I wondered, you know, was that really a you know, did we miss the really great one? And she was starting to answer, and then I hear Ivy over to my left say, "Look at me." I turn around, and he says, "You've got this young artist, and she does this take, and you think, well, it's not quite there. She can do better than that. So do you say that, or do you say, 'Oh, gee, I'm sorry, I didn't record it. Can we do it again?'"
How to handle an artist.
And Martha, you know, her jaw dropped open. Nobody had ever told her that. She had always believed the story that, you know, it hadn't been recorded.
That's a great story. You know, you explain in your book, Ready for a Brand New Beat, how the rhythm and blues of the 50s was really targeted at black audiences. And before that, black music had come out of slavery. And as you point out, Mark, whites had swing, blacks had R&B. Now, take us up to that summer of 64 and give us a sense, what was the position of black music and black artists in that summer?
Yeah, so, you know, the bulk of the African-American population of the United States was rural and southern. And then in the first part of the 20th century, they started moving north. And by mid-century, the bulk of the population was northern and urban. So that, of course, changed the music. So instead of having rural blues and gospel, you had a music with a much harder beat, electric instruments, and it was called rhythm and blues. And rhythm and blues was black music.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, black music and white music were completely separate, made by different people, different record companies, sold in different record stores, played on different radio stations with different DJs, and, you know, so different that Billboard charts had a black chart and a white chart.
Right.
The black chart was called the R&B chart. That's what R&B meant. And then, you know, this idea started emerging of integration. And a lot of white people, obviously not all, but a lot of white people, especially young white people, thought this was a pretty great idea. And those young white people, the white people who were interested in the idea of integration, very logically started getting interested in black culture. That meant black music, and they started listening to R&B. And then, of course, you had, you know, rebellious, bad white boys from the South who went to the wrong side of town and learned the music and learned the vocalization and the clothes and the dance moves. And, you know, and you get Elvis Presley and
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Right.
Yes.
And so, you know, now there's a white R&B world. And Alan Freed, the great promoter of rock and roll, originally a Cleveland DJ and then New York, invented the term rock and roll because he didn't like it. It was sort of a problem. If you said rhythm and blues, it meant music for black people.
Mm-hmm.
So rock and roll meant R&B for white people. And, of course, this was all very interesting for people like Barry Gordy, black people in the music industry, because the white market was about eight times the size of the black market.
A lot of money to be made.
Yeah.
By the time we're looking at that summer in 64, you had that whole issue of the British invasion and all these Brits who had grown up worshiping black R&B artists.
You know, with all of this controversy and trouble that people got into, rock and roll hit a period when it was said to be dead. It actually wasn't dead. I mean, there were actually a number of really great performers, but it wasn't as hot as it had been in the 50s. And it was in that period that the British started taking up the slack. They had loved the old rock and roll, and you know, people like the Beatles and Mick Jagger and, you know, said, well, what's happened? It sort of died. So they started doing it. And, 1964 was the year that both the Beatles and Rolling Stones first came to America.
Yes.
And really, the only thing, if you look at the charts in those days, they were completely dominated by either British groups or Motown.
They were. I remember vividly from I've kept the music guides from the station I listened to as I grew up here in Detroit. I'm speaking with writer Mark Kurlansky, whose book, Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America, looking at that hit, Martha and the Vandellas' Motown song, and how it became the rallying point for some very important moments in history. When you talk about that summer of 64 and then the year or so after, as that song just became a giant hit, give us a sense, a snapshot of what was happening politically and socially in America, because it just was, it's mind-boggling when you look back and realize.
It is. I have an appendix in the back of the book just listing what happened in the summer of 64.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's unbelievable. I mean, the song came out July 31st. 2 days later, the Vietnam War officially began. The first of hundreds of black inner-city uprisings took place in Harlem a couple of weeks before the song.
The Civil Rights Act was passed.
It was the heart of the Mississippi Freedom Summer.
Yes.
And Goodman and Cheney and Schwarmer had disappeared, mm-hmm. and the front page of the paper every day was about the search for their bodies. It was a presidential election year, and people forget how important an election year it was. Goldwater Johnson completely changed the nature of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the nature of American politics. You know, that whole red state, blue state map completely changed in 64. Mm-hmm. So it was an extremely significant summer politically. But, you know, one of the big changes was these uprisings that started to happen every summer in every urban area with an important black community.
We got ours in Detroit in 1967.
Absolutely. In 1967, yeah. I mean, Detroit was one of the big ones. But, you know, there were 120 of them just in the summer of 1967. And, you know, here is this song that says, you know, first it has this very strong black voice, this trumpet call and the strong voice saying, calling out around the world.
Yeah.
And are you ready for a brand new beat? Summer is here and the time is right for dancing in the streets. What's that supposed to mean? And then they're dancing in Chicago, and it starts listing all of these cities which had large, volatile black communities. And by the way, Marvin Gaye was the one who did the list, except for Detroit.
Hmm.
He was listing all the cities, and Ivy Joe Hunter said, "Hey, don't forget the Motor City."
And that went
into the song exactly like that. Don't forget the Motor City.
But Martha always insisted, didn't she, that that song was about a street party and having a good time. And so who began?
Absolutely, and I have no doubt that to her it was.
Okay. What about to the writers? What about to Stevenson and Marvin Gaye and
Well,
and
you know,
Hunter?
Gaye would have been interesting. He of course, died years ago, killed by his father.
Yes.
But, you know, Gaye was very political, and he's the one who, for years, had this argument with Berry Gordy, his brother-in-law, saying that, you know, Motown can't just be about love and heartache. We've got to take on these issues. These are important issues, and we're going to be irrelevant if we don't take them on.
So was this a case of what was often something that happened in black music called masking?
Well, quite possibly. You know, this was a very old, strong tradition in black music, so much so that, you know, when black people hear a song, the first thing they do is try to figure out what the real meaning is.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mickey Stevenson told me that the origin of the song was he was driving around in Detroit one day with Marvin Gaye, and they saw a bunch of kids, black and white, playing in, this was in the summertime on a hot day, and they were playing with a fire hydrant. And to him, this song was about integration.
Hmm.
So Mickey Stevenson did see a political meaning to the song, although not the one that's usually ascribed to it. So it's, you know, it's very difficult. And also don't forget that the whole concept of masking, the whole tradition of masking is that you never admit it. You know,
That's true.
You know, like follow the drinking gourd. You don't say, yes, this was actually about the Underground Railroad and escaping to the North. You know?
Sure.
So we might never know. But, you know, clearly in talking to Mickey Stevenson, I had the impression that, you know, there certainly were intended political undercurrents. But
and it's worth noting, isn't it, that after 9/11, broadcasting giant Clear Channel put Dancing in the Streets on a list of songs its radio stations, many of them, should not play.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? 2001, and it was still considered a dangerous song to play at a difficult moment.
Yeah, I do remember that. So how is Martha, as you talk with her, or Mickey, how are they about the fact that that song has come to embody the spirit of revolution for blacks, and then later for women in the early 70s.
Yeah, Sarah Dash, who sang it with Patti LaBelle and Laura Nero, said that, you know, as far as she was concerned, it was a song about emerging feminism. But I kind of got the feeling that Mickey Stevenson liked all this. Martha does not. Dating back to 1967, even before that at Watts, you know, that they used to say that this song was inspiring, you know, was causing people to riot. This, of course, was white people saying this.
Sure.
And, you know, it was a kind of a racist thing that, you know, black people just sit around in their lackadaisical way, but then along comes the song, and then they go out on the street and start burning down buildings.
I mean, it's
an absurd concept. But, you know, there were a lot of people who genuinely believed that, you know, this song inspired people to riot. And this was pretty upsetting to Martha, who doesn't like violence. And she was asked at a press conference in 67 if she had inspired the Detroit and Newark riots. And she still almost comes to tears when she talks about it. You know, she doesn't want to be held responsible for these things.
What drew you to this song? What made you go to all of this and dig into this and write this book?
Well, it was a great opportunity to get at a few things I wanted to talk about that don't get talked about enough. One being how the struggle for black rights completely changed American music. And, you know, it would have been totally different without it. There wouldn't have been rock and roll without it.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that it shows the importance of a song. You know, this song was one of 50 songs that's in the U.S. National Archive of great songs that are iconic to American culture. And, you know, it shows, partly by, you know, just enduring, it shows the importance of a song. Songs tell us all about who who we are, what we came from, and what we aspire to be. And I thought this was a great time to think about that.
The book is Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America. And I've been speaking with the author, Mark Kurlansky. Thanks so much for your time today, Mark.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Coming up, we discover a Panera Cafe with a difference. No prices, just suggested donations. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The community cafe, it's a concept catching on all across the country. Open a restaurant, serve good food, let the patrons choose their portions, and let them price the portions themselves. The goal? To eliminate hunger, eliminate food waste, and create food security. Denise Serretta launched the community cafe 10 years ago with her One World Cafe in Salt Lake City. From that start, she's gone on to found a nonprofit called One World Everybody Eats. And that nonprofit has guided some 36 community cafes across the country, including some in Michigan, with more in the planning stages. Denise Serretta joins us now from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Welcome to Stateside, Denise.
Thank you.
Take us back to that first cafe in Salt Lake City. How did it come about?
Well, it was really a Field of Dreams experience. I was an acupuncturist. I closed my clinic, and I went into a cafe that I had started, and I start cooking and serving, and a couple months into it, I just really had this Field of Dreams moment where I sort of heard with my spiritual ears, go to donation, let people price their own food. And I think for once in my life, I didn't talk myself out of it. I just, the next person that walked through the door, I did it.
And what did that person think when you said, pay what you think you can?
You know, I think there was this gigantic pause, and they just looked at me, and and they were like, okay. I'm like, I'm not pricing anymore.
And one would think, based on the idea of keeping a business afloat, that it would have been hard to keep the business afloat. Was it?
Well, it was a new business, and you have to factor in that I really didn't have any restaurant experience. So, but with all that said, it worked. I think people, the community of Salt Lake, rose to the occasion. They thought it was a little bit strange, but let's see where this goes. And it just really caught on, and people got it.
And from that, you've gone on to found the nonprofit called One World Everybody Eats. And how is it that your hope that the community cafe movement will impact the problems of food insecurity and food waste?
I think I really realized at the end of the day what is really happening is communities being built. And I think when we open our hearts and we realize that it's humanity at its finest, it changes lives. And with that said, we're serving wonderful food. We're ending food waste. Everyone can eat good local organic food if they want to, regardless of their means.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important.
And that has to feel real, real good for those who do that. And people also volunteer in order to kind of pay for their meals as well?
They do. And people also volunteer because they love the concept.
Mm.
So, again, there's that anonymity. You don't know who's volunteering, who earned a meal, who overpaid for a meal. Everybody is just eating together.
Your foundation, One World Everybody Eats, guides those who want to open a community cafe. There's support and consultation and business models. What does it take to run a successful community cafe?
Well, I think initially it takes a inspired visionary in the community to get something started. It just takes an involved community. Just it can happen in so many ways. Someone could have the funds and open the cafe. Other cafes have started more grassroots with fundraisers and have taken, you know, a couple of years to get the funds. But it has to start with that.
Denise Serretta, founder of One World Everybody Eats, and you can learn lots more about community cafes on their website, and that includes locations and cafes that are in the planning stage. We have many of those in Michigan, and even recipes. You can go to One World Everybody Eats Foundation.org. And Denise joined us today from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thank you so much, Denise.
Thank you.
So let's turn now to one of the community cafes right here in Michigan. It's called Panera Cares. It's a nonprofit Panera Bread location in Dearborn that uses the pay what you can model. Kate Antonacci is the director of societal impact initiatives for Panera, and she joins us from corporate headquarters in Boston. Kate, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, many of us have eaten at a Panera. Tell us, how are things different if we walk into the Panera Cares in Dearborn?
First of all, a lot of things are different. The most important thing is that these cafes, as you said, are run as nonprofits. So they're actually not run by Panera LLC, the corporate entity. They're run by the Panera Bread Foundation, which is a separate 501c3 nonprofit. So, you know, we essentially have opened these cafes as a gift to the community. We are trying to do a service. We're trying to make a difference for the 1 in 6 people who are food insecure, who are hungry, who are missing a week's worth of meals each month, and who often don't know where to go. And we were looking to create a really dignified feeding experience, even if people couldn't necessarily afford to pay full price for the food that they receive. So the biggest difference at our cafe is that we don't have prices. We have suggested donation amounts, and we don't have cash registers. We have donation bins that we use to collect the funds that people decide to contribute for their meal. But essentially, anyone can come in, and it doesn't matter what your means are. You can leave the suggested amount. You can leave more to help cover the cost of somebody else's meal, or you can leave less if you have the need and are looking for a good meal. And so that really was the spirit behind Panera Cares, and that the cafe in Dearborn was the second one that we opened. That was back in 2010, and we now have 5 across the country. And we think it's a really powerful way to try to make a difference for people who are hungry in a really unique way. It's not a soup kitchen. You go in and it feels exactly like a Panera restaurant, and that really was our intent.
So the menu is the same. It's the same feel. Why was Dearborn chosen? I'm curious, Kate.
Yeah, with all of our sites, you know, in order for this to work, we need a mix of people coming in. So this wouldn't work, this concept would not work if we went into a chronically poor neighborhood where the only people who were coming in were those in need.
Yeah.
At the same time, it wouldn't work if we went into an entirely affluent neighborhood where the only people who were coming in were those who could contribute. And so we look for sites that are economically diverse, that have all different kinds of people living and working in the area. We look for places that are accessible by public transit. Many of our sites are in sort of working neighborhoods. There are lots of local businesses around us. You know, right there in Dearborn, there are lots of places that you can walk to. But there are a lot of families that live nearby. It just had a really great mix of people, and that's what we need in order for these cafes to sustain, because ultimately they're sustained by the community. The donations that come into the cafe are literally what we use to cover all of the direct operating costs of the cafe. So we're very reliant on people coming in and choosing to contribute if they support our idea.
I'm speaking with Kate Antonacci, who's the project manager of Panera Cares, the nonprofit Panera Bread location. There are 5 in the country, and there's 1 in Dearborn using the Pay What You Can model, and it's run by the Panera Bread Foundation. Since 2010, since the doors opened, Kate, in Dearborn, how successful has this location been? And actually, what do you define as success?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's not one specific thing. We look at a couple of areas. So we look at the sustainability of the concept. Is it able to cover its costs and keep its doors open and keep its lights on? I mean, that is extremely important, because this was never meant to be something that was permanently funded by Panera. It's meant to be a self-sustaining community operation. And so that's one area. And then the other is we look at our credibility. Do we really think that we're making a difference in the community? And do the people who live and work and around us and come to us on a frequent basis, do they think that we're actually making a difference? You know, we don't want to be full of it. We want to actually provide a service in the community. And so our credibility is another measure. And then our programming. We run additional programming out of all of these cafes, volunteer programs, job training programs. We have one at the Dearborn Cafe, and so that's extremely important too. So we look really at all three, and I would say if you looked at the sustainability of that cafe, we run about, I would say we bring in about 75% of the retail value of the food. So if you're bringing in $10 before for a sandwich, and now we're bringing in about, you know, $7, $7.50 mm-hmm. on average, which is enough for us to feel like over the long term, we'll be able to get to a point of sustainability and maintain that. And then in terms of our credibility, I think we really do a good job of that, and we build deep relationships within the community, and I think that's really amplified by the job training program that we run and the youth that we're able to bring through our cafe and train them, try to get ahead of the cycle of hunger and provide them with jobs that, you know, will help them in the longer term to be able to pay for their own meals and be a working citizen.
What kind of job training, Kate, is being done there?
So we offer, we started this in our St. Louis cafe, which was the first one, and we've replicated the program in other various cities. Essentially, we bring participants in. In the case of Dearborn, we're working with a program through a school, and we bring youth in, and we essentially train them just like we would train any associate that we bring on board. We require them to become certified in different positions, so barista or you know, production line or dishwashing, mm-hmm. and they become certified. They do all of the same testing that our associate would. They work in the cafe for a set number of hours each week. And then we supplement it with life skill training because we know that a lot of these youth have never had a job and they need to know how to do the job, but they also need to know what it means to show up on time, in uniform, you know, how to interview for a job. All of those life skills are really important and they're often not taught. So the program is really twofold, and usually it lasts about 10 to 12 weeks. And then toward the end of the program, we take all the youth through helping them apply for jobs and interview. Oftentimes it's at other Panera cafes, with the goal being that they would earn the job themselves and become a full-time Panera employee. So that's a program we're really excited about, and we feel like makes a long-term difference in the lives of these kids.
And what are the company's hopes for the future of this program? Does the Panera Bread Foundation see even more as time goes on?
For Panera Cares, I think we would say we'll see. You know, the measures that I talked about, uh-huh. you know, credibility, sustainability, programming, we look at those regularly because we know that our ability to be credible in these five communities that we're in right now is really the currency that we need to continue to do this. You know, we don't want to continue to do it if we don't think it's making a difference. And so we're always looking for new sites. We're always looking for communities that could really benefit from something like this. I'm sure Denise talked to you about this, but, you know, when you have hunger literally in every single community and county in the United States, I don't think there's a place where this wouldn't make a difference. I think anywhere we brought a Cares Cafe, I think we would be doing a service. And so for us, the question is really just making sure that the concept sustains over time, and then we continue to grow it appropriately. So right now we don't have any other sites identified, but, you know, as I said, we're always looking, and we think it's a really powerful concept.
Kate Antonacci is the project manager of Panera Cares, and one of the five Panera Cares locations is in Dearborn, where you can walk in and pay what you can. And she joined us from Boston. Kate, thanks for talking with us today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project explores just what it takes to give all kids in Michigan a fair chance at getting ahead. State of Opportunity's story booth goes out all across the state to capture stories we might not otherwise hear. This summer, the booth went to the West Michigan Center for Arts and Technology, where teenagers shared stories about what art means to them. The center, or WMCAT as they call it, is in Grand Rapids, and that's a place where only a handful of public schools still offer art classes of any type. Keon Pearson and her son Keontae Seymour both came into the booth to talk to each other about what access to art education has meant to Keontae. State of Opportunity's youth journalist Alex Wilson produced this audio postcard.
My name is Keontae Seymour. I'm 15 years old.
A lot of people say he's different, but in my eyes, when I see it, I see creativity.
We are at the WMCAT building in the back in the technology room. WMCAT to me is basically an arts and technology program for Grand Rapids Public School students to come and work on like art or technology part. It's like video games. Mom, when you were younger, who do you thought that you were?
I thought that I was different than other people. And it took me a long time to find out who I was in the inside. Since you've been going here, I've seen you grow, you've matured, and you've turned into a different young man.
I hope to be like a kind person that can be like a good friend to other people and not be used by people. And other than like, I just want to like not be like a troublemaker. I like to come here to do like video games because I'm a video game person. I love playing video games, and I get most ideas from video games that I play and turn into my own.
This place lets you express yourself, and whenever you're here, you're not judged. And I can tell in your eyes that you love this place and you adore this place because you get so excited just to come here, and I'm just lost for words because I'm happy that this is, it's doing what I wanted it to do for you.
I know that. I feel like love, like she actually loves that I'm going to this place and like making new friends and everything and getting to like make things with like my family and stuff, showing like how artistic I can be. I wanted to show them like that I can be somebody. I can be an artist, I can be some, at least a somebody.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first. A reminder for you, our next Issues and Ale event's coming up tomorrow in Ann Arbor. You can join political analyst Jack Lessenberry, Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta, and our political junkie Zoe Clark for a special It's Just Politics event. It's tomorrow, 6 p.m. at Bill's Beer Garden in downtown Ann Arbor, and admission is free. You can get all the information at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.